Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Cooper Talks. Today I'm doing something on politics. I'm going to be looking at, well, the title of this is The Revolt of the Right, trying to look at what's been going on in the UK, USA and other areas of Europe over the last few years, trying to explain it and put it into some perspective. Mostly I'll focus on the UK, but with some reference to America and Europe as a whole. I'm doing this today because it is currently the 10th of December, just a couple of days before Britain goes to the polls for the 2019 general election, the election nobody wanted, but seems to be here nonetheless. And looking at the polls for today, which of course could be horrendously wrong, but the latest YouGov poll has the Conservative Party on 43% of the vote and 359 seats, which would give them a majority of 68. Which does seem odd for a party that has shifted markedly to the right. And I'm going to try and explain why that's happened, as well as putting it into the context of recent political trends. So where to begin? First of all, what do we mean by a revolt, and has there really been one? The rise of right-wing votes in Europe has been going on since the 1980s. Now, while the likes of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, Frank Petri and the AfD in Germany and Marine Le Pen haven't made a substantial breakthrough to get power, the fact that they're being talked about in greater detail highlights a rightward shift in politics in Western Europe. But that hardly makes it a revolt. Frank Petri and the AfD only managed to get about 12% of the vote in Germany, enough to secure them seats. First time a far-right party had secured seats in Germany since the World War II, but certainly not enough to make it anything like a governing coalition. It is worth bearing in mind, though, that in Austria, the far-right Freedom Party did manage to gain enough seats to join the government as a junior coalition partner until that agreement had collapsed in 2018 over the Freedom Party's involvement in distributing some songbooks containing Nazi propaganda. Perhaps more revolutionary was the victory of Donald Trump, which threw up any number of questions about the state of American politics. As with the rise in UKIP's share of the vote in the 2015 election, Trump's victory showed a deep level of unhappiness and resentment towards established politics and the status quo, and indicates a revolt against the political establishment. Of course, the greatest evidence of a revolt is the EU referendum in the UK in 2016, and the momentous impact that has had, is having, and no doubt will continue to have for many, many decades to come, whatever happens on Thursday. There's a lot of hyperbole about Brexit, but it is fair to say that we haven't yet even scratched the surface of this change. Bad news for those who think it will be done by January 2020. On that basis, I would argue that it hasn't been so much a revolt of the right, but more a revolt against the established political classes. And the perceived drift that's been going on since, well, really the 1960s, towards liberalism and basically isms. A lot of opponents of isms and political correctness who don't like the liberal way the world has been going. So with Trump and Brexit, we can probably say there has been a revolt. But is it really a revolt of the right? Now, here we need to consider what we mean by left and right. Most people look at it as one line and fit parties and movements in a nice row across this line. However, it depends which policies are being addressed. If we look at economic policies, both Trump and UKIP in 2015 and even the Brexit Party of 2019 actually follow a relatively leftist set of policies. The 2015 UKIP manifesto emphasised welfare programmes, taxes on big corporations, wealth redistribution, extra spending on public services and a controlled economy, while Trump campaigned for protecting American jobs, increased military spending and for massive government investment programmes. These are hardly the policies of the economic right and have far more in common with traditional socialist movements. However, UKIP, the now Brexit Party and Trump, and right-wing parties generally are increasingly focused on cultural issues rather than economic issues. On nationalism and identity, on traditional institutions, and most importantly, on reacting against what they perceive to be liberal reforms that have ruined their country. I'm doing air quotes. I realise you can't see that, but still, their country. They don't like the racial, gender, equality that's being granted. They don't enjoy or appreciate the LGBTQ plus trends that are going on. They see all these new rights and modern tolerances and the shifting economic base as a threat and something they're deeply uncomfortable with. These cultural ideas are what are being stressed by the leaders of the right-wing movements, and it is these policies that are winning voters. The fusion of government spending policies for the right sort of people, I'm doing air quotes again, the right sort of people, with a focus on national cultural identity, leads to populism. But the key focus is on the right-wing aspects of this cultural revolt, particularly as cultural issues have taken priority over economic ones in many voters' minds. And it's worth bearing this in mind. When you talk to people, and this a lot of politicians can't seem to get this around their head, they're saying, if we have a hard Brexit or a no-deal Brexit, you will be economically far worse off. And this argument isn't swaying people. They don't care, because in their heart, they're prioritising cultural issues and that freedom and independence they hope to get by leaving the European Union. They are quite happy to pay the economic price. So making appeals on economic matters doesn't make any sense and doesn't have any impact. Now, in the UK and the USA, this revolt of the right has been a long time coming and, of course, does have economic causes. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, you had about 40 and 45% of the voting population were what we'd call C1 and C2 classes. That's the traditional skilled and unskilled working class. This group tended to favour economically liberal policies, such as job protections, higher welfare spending and wealth redistribution, but were culturally conservative, with a small c, favouring tradition, patriotism, nationalism, tough law and order, and so on. They were the key electoral demographic back in the 1950s. So the Conservative and Labour parties could only win elections by appealing to those voters. As a result, manifesto promises throughout the 50s, 60s and 70s were made that appealed to working class voters who demanded left-wing economic policies to support and protect them, but also demanded right-wing cultural policies about tradition, monarchy, decency and a stable and secure world. Herbert Morrison, the grandfather of Peter Mandelson, if anyone's ever heard of him now, and a huge activist within the Labour Party, dismissed any thought of joining the coal and steel community, that's the forerunner of the EEC and EU, in the 1940s, because the Durham miners would not support it. In 1970, it was said that the housewives won it for Heath, Ted Heath, the Conservative Prime Minister, by breaking for his economic security over Wilson's slightly more radical socialism. But if you analyse it down further, it was the working class housewives that won it for Heath in, perhaps, the last great hurrah until now for working class power in Westminster politics. With the collapse in the industrial base of the UK and the closing of mines and factories that happened throughout the 70s and 80s, the promotion and development of education, British society has changed rapidly between the 1950s and 1980s. By the 1980s, the percentage of working class voters had dropped to about 20%, while the middle class grew to about 30%. For this reason, new right economic measures took priority, and privatisation and free markets were preferred to nationalisation and protectionism. Labour's response to this was to go further to the left on the economy, but that was not supported by the general population. The best demonstration of this was in 1983, when during that general election, Labour produced a very socialist left-wing manifesto, quite similar, if you look at it, to Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto, which the party described as the longest suicide note in history. 30 years earlier, its promises for nationalisation and greater wealth redistribution may well have won them the election, but not in 1983. The remaining working class voters, who were still prioritising economic affairs, might still vote Labour. And they did. But they no longer had the power to influence the outcome of the result. The middle classes had become the dominant force and they weren't interested in nationalism, nationalisation and socialist policies. So old Labour could not appeal to this newly powerful middle class bloc economically. But culturally, socially, they could. The middle classes tend to be more liberal in outlook. They tend to be more racially tolerant, favour gender equality and tolerance of different sexualities. The reasons for this are unclear. There's not been a great survey done about this so far. But generally, it's recognised that university study tends to have a liberalising effect on people, perhaps because it requires the leaving of home and mingling with people of different backgrounds and cultures. Anyway, in addition to that, most of the middle classes are not competing with immigrants for jobs. Or at least not don't perceive themselves as competing with immigrants for jobs. So they don't see immigrants or mass migration as a threat. After the failures of the 1980s and 1992, when Labour kept banging on these old economic issues, New Labour and the New Labour Revolution under Tony Blair was begun as an attempt to reach out and win over those middle-class voters, who by the 2000s were making up 40 to 45% of the voting population. In adopting economically conservative policies and socially liberal positions, New Labour won three huge victories by appealing to the middle classes. The working classes were ignored as they no longer mattered. It was all about the middle classes, and Labour shifted to adapt to that general population, what the people were wanting, by effectively becoming Blue Labour, as they were accused. Now, with the Conservative Party, Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats following largely similar policies in the 2000s, the once powerful working class voters were ignored and marginalised. They were, in effect, left behind by the economic and social reforms of the later 20th century. And after their hopes of being recognised after the Labour victory of 1997 were dashed, their response was simply to give up on politics and stop voting. And this is why turnout in elections collapsed from 71% in the late 80s and early in 1992 to the 2001 low of 59%. It left a huge gap in the electoral market, one that was initially filled by the far-right British National Party, but then much more successfully filled by UKIP. So a little background on UKIP. They began life in the LSE as an intellectual group founded by Alan Sked, with its primary focus, indeed its only focus for many years, being opposition to European integration. Although they were able to pick up votes and seats in European parliamentary elections, they never really broke through to the mainstream until they adopted a wide range of policies targeted at these left-behind voters. The message was sent out in a debacle, the Kilroy Silk debacle, when ex-Labour MP Robert Kilroy Silk stood for UKIP and won a seat to the European Parliament and believed he was the leader and tried to shift it in a left-wing position. But at the time, most of UKIP's support was disgruntled Tories, and that was pulling it more conservative to the right. It led to a huge faff, and Kilroy Silk ended up quitting the party. It was all a bit of a mess. However, after that, a guy called Paul Nuttall, who becomes a big figure, working class guy from Liverpool, he realised that UKIP could only go so far as a home for disgruntled ex-conservatives. And it was Nuttall who convinced Nigel Farage to adopt a much more economically socialist set of policies and to tie the issue of immigration to opposition to the EU. The EU has never been, until now, a big electoral issue. It's normally sort of 8th to 13th on people's priorities. But immigration is quite often in the top two for a number of people. Now, it took a decade for this strategy to take root, and it only became apparent with Farage's second spell as leader of UKIP from November 2010, with his increased focus on man in the pub, decent British people, and playing on the hatred of the Westminster establishment, especially in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008 and the MP's expenses scandal of 2010. He was in a position to point out the corruption of Westminster, that all the parties in Westminster were seemingly corrupt and not to be trusted, and that the British people were fed up with elites telling them what to do. Farage set UKIP up as a party of the left-behind voters, and his success was not in convincing voters from other parties, but in giving the left-behind voters something to vote for, by playing to their concerns and fears of the modern world. Now, who are these left-behind voters that Nigel Farage was able to appeal to? Well, there's a big stereotype here, but generally they tend to be older, usually over 50, white, predominantly male, with low education, normally no more than GCSE level, normally left school at 16, and they tend to live within 20 miles of where they were born, usually in areas of deprivation, formerly prosperous towns, places like Margate, Clacton, Rotherham, that have fallen on economic hard times. Now, these are the people who feel left behind by the economic reforms that the UK has seen, as towns like Clacton, Margate, Thanet, Rotherham, Oldham, etc. have seen declining wealth and employment, while ethnically diverse major urban centres have prospered, places like London, obviously, in the southeast, but also Sheffield, Birmingham, Manchester and Liverpool. So they feel resentment at the comparative prosperity. They feel left behind and threatened by a modern world of technology, immigrants and social liberalism, those immigrants with limited English, socially liberal laws and a world they do not understand. It's a world that is very different from the Britain of their youth, when things appeared to be so much better. Like many on the right, their desire is to turn the clock back to a golden era, usually the 1950s, and to make their country great again by returning to this wonderful past that never really existed beyond the pages of Enid Blyton and Agatha Christie novels. These voters are predominantly anti-EU, seeing the idea of foreigners telling British people what to do as a reason for their problems. But anti-EU feelings alone do not equate to electoral support. UKIP voters traditionally, and Brexit supporters today, will be also anti-immigration, anti-mainstream parties, and pessimistic about the future. Anyone looking at Trump's election campaign, or Wilders in the Netherlands, or Le Pen's in France, or the growth of the AfD in Germany, will note very similar themes. UKIP's successful co-option of the immigration issue helped to boost its support after the 2010 general election, as did the Liberal Democrats joining the Conservatives in government, which meant that the Lib Dems couldn't claim to be a protest party. So that traditional seat of, I can't vote Labour, I can't vote Conservatives, I'll vote Lib Dems in protest, that was removed because they'd been in government. They were going to be held responsible for it and how. And that's why you have a number of, I mean, it seems bizarre, but that's why you have a number of UKIP voters in 2015 saying that they had voted Liberal Democrat in the past. Not because of ideology, it was simply a protest against the two mainstream parties. There's also an increasing sense that all mainstream parties by 2015 were the same. There wasn't anything to choose between the Conservatives, New Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And people wanted change. They wanted something different. In particular, many of the left behind, who may have voted Conservative in 2010 or 2015, could not bring themselves to vote for David Cameron, seeing his Liberal agenda for hugging hoodies, the Great Society and championing gay marriage as alien to their sensibilities. And of course, his privileged background as an Etonian and Oxford graduate, unlike the old Alainian and city broker Farage, also alienated many, many people. Many of these left behind voters may have been tempted to vote Conservative, but could never bring themselves to support Cameron because of his cultural liberalism. On a similar note, many vehemently opposed Ed Miliband and, of course, Jeremy Corbyn's very socially liberal stances on immigration, which is why back in the day when Jeremy Corbyn went to visit the huge immigration camp known as the Jungle outside Calais and was shown being sympathetic to the immigrants and then saying that Britain needed to provide a home to these people, was the worst thing Corbyn could have done if he wanted to win those voters back. And those voters, those left-behind voters, used to be the core of the Labour Party. So his socially liberal policies, and Emily Thornberry famously mocking a white van man with a Union Jack in Rochester, showed the disassociation between the North London Liberal Labour Party and the traditional working class, non-urban or outside the urban centres, who just don't feel any connection to the policies of the current Labour Party or the current Labour Party leadership. Finally, the left behind see the slow economic recovery since 2008 as bypassing them and believe that things will only get worse in Britain's future. They see places like London getting better, the house prices going up. If you're in somewhere like Clacton or Margate or Thanet, you can't help but compare the fact that your towns are still getting poorer while these areas are getting wealthier. The same pretty much is true in American politics, and the same people are being targeted by right-wing parties across Europe. By appealing to the left behind, to all those disgruntled Conservatives, disgruntled Labour voters, and those who felt betrayed by the Liberal Democrats, UKIP managed to reach 15% in the opinion polls in 2014, and were boosted further by the defection of two Conservative MPs to UKIP. This enabled them to force Cameron's hand in coming to an EU referendum to prevent the Conservatives potentially losing seats to UKIP in 2015. Although that support dropped from 15%, UKIP still managed to take 12.6% of the national vote, which is huge, even if they only won one seat. And that was much the same proportion as voted for Wilders in the Netherlands, so kind of comparable trends. It was the first-past-the-post voting system that was just too much of a barrier to UKIP as a party, and quite possibly will be a barrier to the Brexit Party on Thursday. But they at least had their in-out EU referendum, which they'd set up as kind of the solution to all of Europe's problems, or all of the left-behind voters' problems. Now, the EU referendum was where we see the revolt of the right really kick in. Had the turnout for the referendum been the same as it was in the 2015 general election, there is little doubt that the result would have gone the other way. The main parties believed that turnout would be similar and based their results and calculations on this. They forgot about the left-behind voters. But just as many had found a voice in UKIP, many of them realised that their vote would matter, that it could make a difference. They turned out in numbers. Some people who had not voted in an election for 30, 40, even 50 years voted in the referendum. The pollsters missed them because the left behind do not vote. They are not online and they do not participate in Twitter debates or online forums, so they are missed by those in authority. Those left behind voters turned out in their masses, while the votes of regular middle class voters were slightly lower than it had been in elections. The left behind voters did revolt and they swung the decision to leave. Much the same happened in America. The opinion polls there in 2016 also missed the left-behind voters. And so there was the shock of Donald Trump winning in the States. When Donald Trump said he loved the uneducated and they loved him, the left laughed. But it was the left-behind he was referring to, and the left-behind who won in the key states of Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, all going through similar issues of economic deprivation and cultural dislocation that we see in those sort of centres like Margate and so on in the UK. But here we need to stop and consider the longevity of the revolt of the right. If it is a true revolt, then it will lead to permanent repositioning in politics. Was the election of Trump and the Brexit vote a sign of things to come, or the last throw of the dice by declining force? Well, between 2016 and 2018, it appeared as if the revolt of the right was coming to an end. Brexit was happening. Brexit means Brexit, as we were continually told. So questions were raised about the future role of UKIP. Fights emerged, quite literally, actually, between Red UKIP and Blue UKIP as the unifying force of opposition to the EU started tearing them apart. Their one MP opposed the party leadership quite actively, and the party seemed to be little more than a cult to Nigel Farage, a cult that even he rejected and left to pursue his media career. With Brexit seemingly achieved, it was possible that UKIP and the left-behind voters would once more fade from the political scene. Ironically, this would have been most pronounced once UKIP lost its 22 MEP seats in Europe and Britain no longer voted in EU elections, because it's EU elections where UKIP had received most attention and most support. With the Lib Dems back as an opposition party, people seem to be returning to them as a protest vote, with the Greens also gaining in popularity. It's worth remembering that the left behind in Scotland have been breaking for the SNP, for much the same reasons as their English equivalents have been breaking for UKIP and now the Brexit Party. While the SNP may be a nationalist party, it would be difficult to describe them as a right-wing force. For all Trump's populism, if he cannot deliver on his promises, the revolt in the USA is likely to fade, and considering that many of the jobs in America's Rust Belt have been lost to microchips rather than Mexicans, it is unlikely that any immigration reform, wall or not, is going to bring back employment. The promises of employment and better wages seem an impossible dream. Proportional representation means that Wilders was never going to be forming an integral part of a coalition government in the Netherlands, and the second ballot system that the French use meant that basically even if Le Pen got through to the top two, the majority of French people would vote for anyone but Le Pen in a two-way contest. Just as happened to her father in 2002 and proved to be the case when she was up against Macron. Perhaps, also it seemed in 2018, we could do as mainstream politicians had done since the 1990s and ignore the revolt of the right, safe in the knowledge that they will soon fade and disengage from politics. That was a mistake. UKIP may have faded, but the agonising in debates over a deal and second referendum have seen the emergence of Nigel Farage's new project, the Brexit Party, which gained 26 seats in the 2019 European Parliament elections with 5.6 million votes and or 30.2% of the votes cast. Demanding a hard deal, no deal, and expressing the concerns of voters frustrated with the prevarication of Westminster and feeling, once again, that the political establishment was ignoring their voice. The Brexit Party will continue to ignite populist passions against the EU and immigration and has succeeded in forcing the Conservative Party to a much harder position, with a number of traditional Conservative stalwarts, like David Gawk, Ken Clark and Philip Hammond, actually being expelled from the party for being too liberal over Brexit. And yes, I'm doing air quotes over liberal because I never thought Philip Hammond would be too liberal for anything. This is perhaps the most important and meaningful impact of the revolt of the right, as it has managed to shift the Conservative Party in a more populist, economically liberal, but socially conservative position, amply demonstrated by the current manifesto, which promises 50,000 extra nurses, the ongoing triple lock on pensions, promising that no one will have to sell their home to pay for social care, pledging to spend £6.3 billion on 2.2 million disadvantaged homes, proposing a points-based, restrictive immigration system, and of course, getting Brexit done by the end of January 2020. The Conservative Party are relying on the votes of the working class to secure themselves a majority. But rather than through economic policies, they're doing it through social policies. While Jeremy Corbyn is trying to win back those working class voters with policies that would benefit the left behind economically, the liberal social agenda of his Labour Party puts him out of touch with those very voters he needs, and those voters that used to be the heart of the Labour Party. Why has it come to this? Simply because the problems of the left behind voters was not solved by Brexit or the election of Trump, so they continue to exist. And the more the moderate centre and the left mocked them and failed to deliver Brexit, the more they showed how out of touch they were with the core electorate. These voters existed before UKIP, before Brexit, and before Trump, and they will exist even if the Brexit Party does metamorphose into the Reform Party and disappears. Someone will find a way of reaching out to them. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that in 2018, before it was sort of banned, it's a bit dubious what's going on there, the largest Facebook group in the UK, with about 1.5 million members, was the radical right Britain First, which focused on issues similar to UKIP and the Brexit Party. The 1950s were a golden era. Britain should go back to its past. Immigration and liberalism are the scourges of the modern society. Modern politicians have failed, and there is an economic mess that requires strong leadership to look after ordinary, decent Britons. This Facebook group was larger than the Facebook groups of the main parties combined and was growing in popularity before it was sort of taken down in April 2019. If it's not through a more right-wing Conservative Party or the Brexit Party, who will these voters turn to if they're being ignored? Perhaps the revolt of the right is the wrong term. What we've seen is the emergence of the right into mainstream politics. It has been a long time coming in the UK, but it has always been there and will continue to be a force in British politics. Rather than hand-wringing and virtue signalling, or dismissing 14% of the electorate as fruitcakes, loons and bigots, the centrist parties should have begun listening to these voters and trying to tackle their genuine concerns, rather than dismissing them and leaving them to more extremist movements. The Conservative Party, rightly or wrongly, appears to have eventually learnt this lesson and has started listening to them and taking on board their ideas, but at the cost of dividing itself and potentially tearing itself and the country apart. As yet, none of the other parties has provided an adequate home for those centrist Conservatives to rehouse themselves. And Labour's shift towards more extreme economic socialism alienates many of those former Conservative voters, leaving them in limbo and not sure what to do. Rather than reaching out to the Twitterati and celebrity pop culture, instead of focusing almost exclusively on middle-class concerns and liberal agendas, the party leaders should start listening to the voters who do not vote and seeking to help those who feel that society has left them behind. If they had listened to those voters sooner, then the tensions and frustrations that were voiced in the Brexit vote and election of Trump may not have come as a shock and would have been less of a revolt, more of an evolution. It's worth bearing in mind that back in the 1970s, there had been a dramatic rise of the National Front, a forerunner of the British National Party, very right-wing and fascist. That threat was nullified when Margaret Thatcher shifted the Conservative Party a bit further to the right. Although it cost some centrist support, it nullified that threat to the right before it became a serious threat. That was the mistake the Conservative Party made by not listening to those voters sooner. If they had listened to them, perhaps they would not have had to shout to get attention. If the mainstream and centrist parties had begun listening to these voters and paying some attention to their real concerns, they may have found the right revolting less, if not less revolting, depending on your point of view. So I hope that's been useful and given you some ideas about the way politics has changed and the trying to explain things. Obviously, this is on the Tuesday before the election, so depending on the result, I'm going to sound very prescient and with it, or completely wrong and out of touch, depending on how the election swings. But I hope it gives you some flavour and some ideas about the right wing in politics, makes you appreciate or understand a little bit what's been going on over the last few years. Feel free to leave a comment. Otherwise, I will speak to you again soon with some other delightfully interesting and fascinating account from the world of politics. Bye.